Hello and welcome back to Ye Olde Guide, your podcast tour of the history and heritage of English towns and cities. Today we've got a city of superlatives, steeped in history and, well, also in places rather steep. Today we're visiting Lincoln. My name is Liam McGrath and I'm delighted to introduce my co-host Daniel Gooch. So, Daniel, what did you make of Lincoln on our visit?
I thought it was a great city. Lots of heritage, lots of fantastic old buildings, which I'm really looking forward to discussing. And almost as important, we saw Ipswich get their first win of the season when we were there. So it was a doubly fantastic trip.
Turning point of the season. So, to be honest, I think we've both been to Lincoln quite a few times over the years. And we will, of course, in this podcast, be talking about the very famous cathedral, castle and historic buildings that many listeners will know about and might even have visited themselves. But this podcast is trying to dig a bit deeper into other areas of heritage in the cities we visit. And to do that, we've split our episodes into four sections of inquiry. Firstly, we'll be looking into cultural influences of Lincoln. Then we'll be looking at the history of politics and war in Lincoln. Then science and industry. And finally, we'll come on to an urban landscape where we'll be getting into those remarkable buildings. And we certainly won't have enough time to do Lincoln justice, but we will certainly try. We have a final category called reality versus expectations. For a little entertainment along the way, we give a score for historical legacy and importance in each of those categories. You can learn more about the podcast on our website, yeoldeguide.com. You can also leave feedback and comments on this episode, questions, and if you think there's anything we've missed, please do get in touch via the website yeoldeguide.com. Lincoln's located in, well, Lincolnshire in the East Midlands, sort of the east of the East Midlands, in a relatively flat part of England. Although it's the exceptional hill at Lincoln that's really given rise to the settlement, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think when you go to Lincoln, the geography of the city really hits you. It's really characterised by this very steep hill from which the city centre spreads downwards. It was initially founded actually as a Roman fortress around 60 AD on top of that hill as a defensible location. And then later as a Roman colonia, which was a centre for retired soldiers around 85 AD. Excavations have revealed the Roman fortress sitting on top of the hill in Lincoln's centre. But Roman civilian buildings did grow to the south of the fortress down that steep hill once the legion moved to York and it became a colonia. Now, as with many other British towns, Lincoln was almost completely deserted when the Romans left Britain. It was later resettled by the Vikings. They probably only occupied the top of the hill at first. Lincoln remained under Viking control and became a burgh, or a fortified town, under their occupation. And by the time of the Norman Conquest, Lincoln had become one of the largest settlements in England. It had then an important mint, a key commercial centre, and about 1,000 houses. And it became the centre of a bishopric in 1072, which really reflected its importance at the time. Following this, Lincoln grew to be the third largest city in England by the 13th century. But it gradually lost its regional prominence to the nearby town of Boston. And it became, again, a bit deserted by the 15th century as regional and its national importance declined. The population of the city fell possibly to levels that it hadn't seen since even Saxon times. And this resulted in lots of open areas and empty parishes within the city. This urban decline was really exacerbated by the Reformation. The city was full of religious houses and several parishes, which the city just completely lost then. There were seven monasteries in the city at the point of the dissolution. So this loss of patronage and power really did hit Lincoln hard. In fact, there's a poem which possibly dates the 15th century, which was still being quoted in travel writing in the 18th, which included the line, "Lincoln was, London is, and York shall be the fine city of the three." And this gives you some idea of the popular image of pre-industrial Lincoln as a great city of the past, but not at that time of the present. However, there's a happier ending to it when, as Lincoln rose again in the 18th century, thanks in part to agricultural expansion in the region around it, but also to its connections to the burgeoning canal system that wove its way around Britain. The city later became a cultural centre and it underwent a massive population increase from 4,500 in 1750 up to 60,000 in 1911, which is not all that far off what it is in the present day. And modern Lincoln is today a major tourist centre, and for reasons I think we will cover in more detail later in the podcast.
So today, Lincoln, we're left with city, a bit under 100,000 population. It's the central city of Lincolnshire, which is relatively sparsely populated county, a large county. And I'd say we're left with this legacy of a well-preserved medieval centre, which is very easy to walk around, an absolute pleasure to walk around. And we'll be coming back to talk about some of the buildings in that urban landscape. Let's now go on to our first category. In our first category, culture, we look at the artistic legacies that Lincoln has left for the country and the world. Just to get it out of the way, because we always talk about this, we're going to start with the cloth trade.
Yeah. Have we had an episode where the cloth trade hasn't come up?
Not yet.
No, we're going to get it out of the way early today. I know we do always talk about the cloth trade, but this time we're sitting in a different category, art and culture, and I'll actually tell you something a little bit different on it, which is that Lincoln was historically famous for its green cloth, which was just known very imaginatively as Lincoln Green in the 16th century. This was made from blue woad and yellow weld, and most famously it was associated with Robin Hood. If you think of the traditional image of Robin Hood, it's Lincoln Green that he's wearing.
Never thought of that.
Does have other appearances in popular culture you might be aware of. The Canterbury Tales. In the Friar's Tale from the Canterbury Tales, a devil appears dressed in Lincoln Green. In Ivanhoe, Walter Scott's famous novel, Lincoln Green is mentioned three times. It's mentioned in Vanity Fair by Thackeray. And it was actually worn by Torvald and Dean, who come from fairly near Lincoln, in the 1980 Olympic figure skating competition. That isn't the one where they won the gold medal, but it's still a notable tribute.
They were skating at the Nottingham Ice Arena. Mm. So they were locals, right?
They were from not far at all.
So that's amazing. I never knew about Lincoln Green. And it. But what else have we got? We've got the Lincoln Cathedral Library,
yeah,
which holds some significant texts.
Yes, yeah, so something a bit more tangible that you can see today is the Lincoln Cathedral Library. This is really notable for its architecture and what it contains. Part of the library building was designed by Christopher Wren, who was commissioned specifically to build a new library because of damage wrought on it in the Civil War. It holds several really important books. It holds texts from the Venerable Bede, whose name you might be familiar to you. He was a 7th century monk and one of the earliest English historians. It also holds the first Bible ever published in North America or published into a Native American language, which was published in 1663, known as the Eliot Indian Bible, which was written in the native Massachusetts language.
So a first in Lincoln, and I know these are fairly typical in many British cities now, but a first in Lincoln was the traditional German Christmas market.
That's right. Lincoln was the first city to hold a regular traditional German Christmas market. It started in 1982, so it's fairly recent development. It really started as part of its twinning with the city of Neustadt, and stallholders still come over from Neustadt to the Lincoln Christmas market today. Originally, it was just 11 stalls set up near the castle on the top of the hill. Now there are over 200 each year, and people come from far and wide to visit it. And the number of visitors it attracts each year, it's certainly within six figures. I have to admit, the sources vary wildly on this. The official Christmas market website says 250,000. Other sources say 100,000 people visit it per year. I think the council website said 500,000. So we don't know exactly how many.
It's a huge numbers.
How do you count?
I don't know how you fit that many people into Lincoln. Well, the vast numbers.
nor do I. Or how you'd actually count that. But whatever it is, it's certainly a major attraction every Christmas.
So for all our listeners from outside the UK, we just love a German Christmas market over here. We just love the wooden huts and the bratwurst and the beer and the Christmas music, which is generally British. But we just love it. Every town has one now.
Yeah,
it seems that way.
Certainly, a major thing in all cities in England today. And Lincoln was the first in this country, obviously, not in Germany.
Yeah,
they've been doing them a lot longer. Lincoln doesn't get that much credit.
Brilliant. So, is there any other sort of cultural buildings that we should mention?
I'm going to have one here. I'm going to inject a little bit of personal interest into this. There's something called, I think it's just called the Grandstand. It's just kind of on the periphery of the city centre. What this is a preserved grandstand built in 1897, so very old in stadium terms, modern stadium terms, from the old Lincoln Racecourse, which closed in 1964. Now, there had been racing since 1727, and I think the stand, which is really well preserved and Grade 2 listed, is now used as a community centre, so there's still some use coming out of it. One quite peculiar point is there is a road, the A57, which goes right up in front of the stand. And you might think that's a modern development, but actually that the A57 ran between the stand and the course while races were still being run there. They used to have to close off the road and divert the traffic during races.
Wow.
So very interesting thing to see today.
That is. Now, I also have to point out that we couldn't get through an episode, could we, without mentioning some kind of sporting historical stand, it seems. If there's podcast bingo, it's ancient sporting infrastructure and the cloth trade.
Yeah, yeah.
Or so it seems.
What okay, day we'll mention neither.
We'll have to find somewhere. Well, let's do the scoring for this category culture then.
Yep.
Who's going first?
I'm happy to go first. I think we've got through that quite quickly. There are some interesting little anecdotes there, but I think it's a real pity there isn't more to say about Lincoln. The library's texts are certainly important, and the Christmas market is an interesting first for modern British culture. You know, Christmas markets have a much longer tradition in German-speaking parts of Europe, you know, back to the Middle Ages, but this is still important for British cultural history. There are, as we said, large Christmas markets, particularly under the influence of Frankfurt, springing up in all major cities, really starting in the late 90s. Even so, it's still not a great showing in this category from Lincoln, particularly for a city which has had, as we're going to see in the next category, so much regional political clout for so long. So it's not going to be a great score for me. I'm going to give it a 1.5.
Great. Yeah, I think that's right. And I will pretty much go along with what you say. I thought the Lincoln Green stuff was interesting, and who doesn't love a Christmas market? So I will be giving Lincoln a 2.
Okay. 3.5 out of 20 overall for Lincoln.
Our second category is politics and war. With a major castle and its strategic location, it's perhaps not surprising that some really major events in the political and military history of England have occurred at Lincoln. There's a huge amount to cover here, but what we're going to do is we're going to start with three major battles: the Anarchy, 1141, the First Barons' War, 1217, and the English Civil War. And then we'll talk later about Lincoln's role, important role in modern warfare. So let's start, we're doing this chronologically, let's start with the Anarchy. Could you give us a very, very quick overview of the Anarchy and what happened in Lincoln?
The Anarchy was a notable period of civil war in the mid-12th century between two claimants to the English throne. There was Matilda, who was the daughter of Henry I. I think she was his only surviving legitimate child, and her cousin Stephen. Matilda was the legitimate heir to the throne, but Stephen essentially, I think you could put it as crudely as this, took the throne when her father Henry I died, and a major civil war ensued across the land. Now, the importance of Lincoln is that the Battle of Lincoln occurred here in 1141, and this really was one of the major battles of the Anarchy. The specific background to this battle is that Stephen had caused offence to the Earl of Chester, who, as we saw in the Chester episode, was a really notable person at this time, by giving lands that the Earl of Chester wanted to his enemies. So in revenge, the Earl rebelled against Stephen, captured Lincoln Castle from the King's forces there. Stephen and his forces then besieged Lincoln Castle with about 1,000, well, just over 1,000 troops. But Matilda's relief force of about a similar number attacked them, and most of Stephen's leading nobles just fled. As well as in the castle, there was fighting in the city streets leading downhill from the castle. Stephen was actually captured and temporarily deposed. He was held in Bristol, which was Matilda's stronghold of the southwest, but later released in a prisoner exchange for Robert of Gloucester, Matilda's half-brother. Now, this battle really should have been a major turning point in the war. Mm. And as we said, Matilda had Stephen as her prisoner. She had the growing support of more nobles. The sources say, and we have to be careful about how we interpret these, though, that she wasn't a great diplomat and she made enemies easily and essentially was chased out of London in June later that year. So she wasn't really able to consolidate her hold on power. But this could have been a really major turning point in the history of the anarchy.
So Stephen was gallantly fighting outside Lincoln Castle. He couldn't manage it. He was captured. He was held prisoner. But somehow he still managed to, in the end, for reasons of diplomacy, it seems, he still managed to end up being king.
He did. The
anarchy, poor Matilda got nothing.
Well, the anarchy concluded essentially with a treaty which allowed Matilda's son, the later Henry II, to become king after Stephen died. And he didn't die all that much later. So everyone was fairly happy about it. I think Stephen's son, who you might have think would have something to say about it, also died. So conveniently got out of the way.
A hard world back then. So it's a hugely important battle outside Lincoln Castle in an era of sort of siege battles, I suppose, where Lincoln Castle would have been very difficult to take.
Absolutely. I think sieges were a lot more common than full-scale battles in the Middle Ages. But I think that brings us on probably to our second Battle of Lincoln in 1217.
It does, yeah.
That really was...
Could you give us a bit of background to the second battle? This is the first Barons' War. But could you tell us how we got to this another civil war, this first Barons' War?
The background is King John, who actually wasn't king at the time of the battle, but he is very relevant to this, lost favour with many of his leading nobles. He was militarily an awful king, lost huge amounts of land in France.
And he was a horrible man, basically.
I think you could probably say that.
Unpleasant.
Was rumoured to have murdered his own nephew. All those portrayals you see of him in Robin Hood have some basis in the sources, and probably in fact too. This led to a major civil war. And actually, John had died by the time of the Battle of Lincoln. But by that point, there'd actually been an invasion from the son of the French king, who of course had been fighting John and John's forces for years in France for possession of John's French territories. So the French Dauphin, which is just the really what they would call the Prince of Wales, had invaded England and teamed up essentially with a load of rebellious northern barons. At the time of the battle, the French forces were within the walled city, so the area of the city that surrounds the top of the city with the castle, and besieging the castle at the top. And that kind of gives you some idea of the layout of the town's fortifications, with the major trading areas, the walled city down the bottom, but the major fortified area right at the top, and how you could easily split control of the two areas between the two.
So I find that remarkable, that the town was effectively occupied by the different side to who was in control of the castle.
Absolutely, yeah. It was much easier to take the lower area than the top area. And actually, this led to quite an important strategic move in the counterattack by English forces. The Royalist forces, I shouldn't really call them English forces because they're English forces on both sides, we'll call them the Royalist forces, were led by William Marshall, very famous English knight, acted as regent to Henry III, who was just a young boy, who was John's son and had succeeded him to the throne. He led the English troops in their counterattack and essentially attacked from the north, not from the south as you might have expected him to, which was an easier area to get to, but for what seems now obvious reason is you don't want to be defending up that steep hill which leads up from the south. That's a very steep hill, it's a huge incline. That would be a very difficult way to attack the top of the hill. He gave this major Churchillian speech. He said, "These men have seized and taken by force our land and our possessions. Shame on the man who does not strive this very day to put up a challenge. If we beat them, it is no lie to say that we have won eternal glory for the rest of our lives." It's, as a Churchillian, almost Shakespearean there. But his forces of about 1,000 attacked Louis, the Dauphin's forces of about 1600 at the castle. As we said, they're taking the city, but not the castle. And now the battle lasted 6 hours. Now, this was a very big gamble. As we said, full medieval battles were very rare because they were so dangerous and risky. You could lose so much in having a full-scale battle with all your leading forces and leading abilities, lives at stake. But essentially, the royal forces were low on funds. The French king was a lot richer than Henry, especially after all the lands he'd managed to capture back from John previously. So they took the risk of attacking. And after 6 hours, the French commander was killed. The royalist forces won the day. And not long after, Louis was forced out of England back home to France. It was really the turning point of the invasion.
Really important. So again, this is a second battle where we've got a real turning point in the Civil War Lincoln Castle.
It's really, I suppose, a bit like the Glorious Revolution, which we talked about in the Reading episode. It's really a forgotten invasion of England. And alternative history is always a very, very dangerous thing, especially when you're talking about an era when the modern concept of the nation state didn't really exist in the same way that it does today.
But it was basically land barons, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's exactly.
Landowners.
Had the royal forces lost, even with all those caveats, there's every chance England would have been in some way subsumed into the landholdings of France, or at the very least kind of brought down to a vassal state status rather than maintaining the same political structure which ensued from that day.
And I don't know where to fit this in, Daniel, but I mean, I think, thinking about the sort of the legacy in Lincoln that you can see as part of this battle. Lincoln Castle, and we may come back to this, Lincoln Castle contains one of the rare copies of the Magna Carta, which was the document which led almost to this civil war.
Yeah, I think I'd probably look at Magna Carta in terms of the outcomes of the war as much as the causes. The battle is, as we said, an important event in a barely remembered invasion, but the political consequences were not just in respect of the different landholdings of the English king and the French Dauphin, but also in respect of the Treaty of Lambeth, which ended the war. This stemmed more or less directly from this battle. And it was at this point that Magna Carta was reissued. It had originally been signed by King John, of course, at Runnymede, but it was reissued after this as part of the peace treaty many times after. But it started to really pick up its major political significance as a document on the rights of individuals after this point.
Right. And that's why Lincoln, when you visit, you really feel this history, because it is one of the only places where you can see the Magna Carta. I think the other copies are in Salisbury and the British Library, the original copies. And
I think British Library has two, which seems a little greedy.
Yeah, two copies in the British Library. But shall we move on to the next set of battles?
Yeah, we will.
The Civil War.
So there were two notable military events in the Civil War. I don't think they're quite as significant as the last two battles, but we'll still talk about them. There was the siege of May 1644, by parliamentarian forces, and also it was attacked in 1648 by royalist forces. The reason that Lincoln was the site of two major military events was really because it was in between East Anglia, which was the heartland of the parliamentary forces, and major battlegrounds further north in the country. The 1644 siege ended with the parliamentarian forces once again taking the lower town first, and then later overrunning the castle areas, is the narrative we've seen in the other two battles. But both battles did cause major damage to the city. The second one completely ruined the medieval Bishop's Palace, which dated from the 1430s, which is actually something you can still see today, the remnants of that palace.
So there's a legacy for the Civil War as well. Shall we zip forward to sort of more modern warfare, where Lincoln has been quite significant in 20th century warfare?
Yep, we can even start a tad further back on that. We can talk about the old barracks.
Yep.
The old barracks, which are still there today in Lincoln, were built in 1857 for the use of the North Lincoln Militia, later on used by the Lincolnshire Yeomanry. The reason why you might want to visit them today, not just for their own personal interest, is because they now house the Museum of Lincolnshire Life, and have done since 1969.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Another stopping point on a visit to Lincoln.
It is, but we can move on to the 20th century and talk about the first ever tank, first ever tank was built in Lincoln, called Little Willy, or more boringly, the number one Lincoln machine. It was a prototype built in 1915 by the company Fosters of Lincoln, which, as its normal course of business, made agricultural machinery. Little Willy was actually tested on the southern outskirts of Lincoln. And if you want to see the site, it's where Tritton Road is today. As I said, it was only a prototype, but other versions did follow and were manufactured in Lincoln. And they include one of the first tanks that was actually used in the First World War, the Mark IV. And that's now on display in the Museum of Lincolnshire Life.
Ah, oh, tremendous. And so Lincoln was known as Tank Town. So clearly considered the centre of tank manufacture at one point. Now, and I have to tell you, I couldn't resist doing a bit of digging into this prototype tank, the first ever tank, and came across an amazing website called tankencyclopedia.com. And I've got some stats for you. The prototype tank weighed 16.5 tons. It had a crew of six and moved at 2 miles per hour. So there you go.
It doesn't seem very quick, but I suppose if you're in a tank, it probably doesn't matter really, does it? If no one's seen one before, how do they stop you?
And I suppose then that was the end of trench warfare, the tank, would you say?
I'm not a military historian, so I couldn't tell.
No, we might skip that comment because we don't actually know. And as well as the tanks, of course, Lincoln was known as a centre for the Bomber Command. And that's memorialised today in a memorial within Lincoln Cathedral, but also the more recently opened Bomber Command Museum, which has all the records of the losses from the bombers. And I think this was significant for Lincoln, as I understand it, because the bases around Lincoln, in particular Waddington, which is just on the edge of the city, had the highest losses in the Second World War. So it's sort of considered the centre of Bomber Command. I think 44% of pilots of those bombers were lost in the Second World War. It was the base where the first Lancaster bombers were flown. So you can visit that memorial and the museum today. So it's another thing to visit in Lincoln that relates to its political and military significance.
And the interesting intangible legacy today, a bit of intangible heritage, I think is in the football club. I know there were plans a few years ago to paint a Dambusters mosaic at the football ground. And I think the fans today even sing the Dambusters theme because of the RAF heritage in the city.
That's a fantastic little factoid. Well, shall we go on to the scoring then? Who's going to go first?
Your turn, I think. You can have the honour.
I think for me, this has got to be a high score. You've talked through three significant battles, or well, four if we count the two in the Civil War, but real turning points in the anarchy and the First Barons' War, and then a big place in modern military history as well. And what I really liked about Lincoln, I tried to allude to this earlier, the presence of the Magna Carta, the presence of the castle, the layout of the town, you can really see and feel it today. Even the modern stuff, the tank in the museum and the Lincolnshire Bomber Command Centre. So for me, it's going to be an 8.5.
I also have very positive thoughts. I mean, there are other things we could have talked about, as well as going into more depth about the battles there. We could have talked about the parliaments that were held there. There were, I think, six parliaments between the 13th and 14th century. Medieval monarchs used to stay there regularly. Henry II may even have undergone a second crowning there in St. Mary's Guildhall. I think as an overall summing up, what I really loved about Lincoln is it's not just this fact that important military and political events happened there, but how much the urban environment of Lincoln, as you experience it today, invokes these events. You don't just feel this in all the preserved grand medieval architecture at the top of at the top of the hill in the castle and the cathedral, but in the way that they're separated geographically on top of the hill from the city below. And you can feel as you walk up that tremendously steep hill just how crucial control of the city's summit must have been to battles, and just how hard attacking or defending up that hill from the rest of the city must have been. There is maybe a tad less to say directly on politics and on war, but as we said, I think the political outcomes of the military actions were huge. I mean, my personal highlight is that Second Battle of Lincoln, probably the most important event in a barely remembered invasion of England. As we said, alternative history is dangerous. Had the English royal forces lost, I think it's fair to say that the political direction of England could have been quite notably different. We talked about the reissuing of Magna Carta, the Treaty of Lambeth, which ended the war, which stemmed more or less directly from this battle. And I think you have to consider that a pretty major political legacy. So it's scoring very strongly in everything. I think it's going to be a 9 for me, which is possibly the highest score I've ever given anywhere. But I think it just deserves it for everything it's achieved in both politics and war, and how you experience and can really see that today.
Wow, that's a massive score and a fascinating category. I really enjoyed that. Our third category is science and industry. And Daniel, you mentioned in the intro Lincoln was a thriving agricultural centre, but what sort of industrial legacy will we see in Lincoln?
I'll give a brief chronology first of kind of how industry has grown up in Lincoln. It was initially a thriving river port in the Middle Ages, a bit like Chester was, which we spoke about in the Chester episode. This was where exotic items arrived for further trade at fairs or at markets. It did decline from the late Middle Ages onwards, when the wool staple, the right to collect taxes on wool, moved from Lincoln to Boston, but rose again in the late 18th century. This was thanks in part to agricultural expansion in its local region, but also to its connection to the canal system. And it became the cultural and market centre for its region, really. Later on, railways meant more industrial expansion to the east and the west of the city. At first, this was in the usual industries that we see in towns of this size, brewing, malting and milling. But later in the 19th century, you saw iron and engineering work set up, which leads to those innovations we saw in tank production later in the early 20th century. You asked about the legacy. I think I'll probably talk about two aspects here. The first is legacy of heavy industry. There's plenty of remaining Victorian and Edwardian warehouses and industrial buildings around the river towards the south of the city down the hill. One of my personal favourites is the former St Mark's station, railway station building, which is now part of a shopping centre. Another is the massive old railway goods depot, which is now a university library. And also the Great Northern Railway's old engine shed, which is now the university student union.
And so I think you've got to give credit for the way those buildings have been restored as well.
You have.
Today.
It's been done in a great way. And I think restoration of buildings in this way adds so much more character to the functions that are contained in there. You've also got another legacy, quite a specific one, is windmills. There used to be loads of windmills in Lincoln. I think there were 9 at one point in the 19th century, which formed quite an incredible skyline. Now only 2 survive, but it's still 2 more than most cities would have. You've got Ellis's Mill, which was built in 1798, which is right near the centre of the town and was restored in the 70s by a local group. And it's fully working and producing flour today. As well as that, on Princess Street, you've got the Tower of Crown Mill, which is the second tallest windmill in the county of Lincolnshire. So you really do have, even away from the main touristy area that everyone goes to Lincoln for at the top of the hill, a really interesting industrial legacy to take you away from there and see another side of Lincoln's history.
I mean, everyone loves a good windmill. And I believe the Ellis Mill has open days. Go in there and see the inner workings of a windmill. Absolutely fascinating.
A fully working windmill, no less.
Produce some wholemeal bread.
Excellent.
And what we also like to do in science and industry is celebrate particular individuals from a town that have made a major contribution. And I think we have to mention Charlotte Angus Scott, who is from Lincoln, a well-known mathematician who specialised in geometry. But that's not really what we want to focus on. She's left equally significant legacy in her presence in mathematics.
She has. So Charlotte Angus Scott was a mathematician from the 19th and the early 20th century who was really instrumental in the education of women in mathematics. She was pioneering as a female head of department at university and supervised several women in their PhD studies. Three of the only 9 women who earned maths PhDs in the 19th century were supervised by her. She was one of the she was the first woman to join the American Mathematical Society and one of the first British women to be awarded a doctorate. She actually received special permission as a woman to sit her exams at Cambridge, but wasn't awarded full recognition for her studies because women weren't usually allowed to take exams at the time. There was uproar among the students, and so the rules were actually changed as a result to allow women to take the exam in the future. Well, sadly, she still wasn't awarded the full degree from the university. She actually had to obtain these, attain her degree from the University of London as an external candidate. So an absolutely fascinating life and legacy there. And her relevance to modern Lincoln, where as we said she is from, is that she's celebrated today in the University of Lincoln's Charlotte Angus Scott Research Fellowship, which encourages postdoctoral study by women in engineering and computer science. So a really, I think, fitting legacy to her life and influence there.
Really important legacy. Shall we go on to the scoring?
I think it's fair to draw out the industrial heritage that remains in the city. I really like this. And as I said, it's a major reason for anyone with a broad interest in history to venture away from the touristy area up the hill and explore the rest of Lincoln. The redevelopment of the old industrial area around the Brayford Pool, the area of water down the bottom of the hill, is also very well done. In all honesty, there hasn't been a huge much else to say. Charlotte Angus Scott is a really impressive daughter of Lincoln. Her links to Lincoln aren't enormously obvious in the city today. Obviously, the research fellowship is a step in the right direction, but it would probably be fair to say she isn't as celebrated as you might think she could be. And I think overall, there's something to say for science industry, but there's not much that Lincoln has given to the world in industry in this category. So I think it's going to be a fairly low score. I'm going to give it a 2.5.
When we do this podcast, we go to cities and towns with really internationally renowned industrial legacies, which we don't see here, although there's clearly important things have gone on here. And, you know, as we discussed in the last category, politics and war, the first tank, tank town, clearly there was a centre of engineering at Lincoln that was important locally with some national implications. I think the legacy that is there, the buildings you've mentioned, the windmills, are fantastic, as is the legacy of Charlotte Angus Scott. But of course, she didn't do her best mathematical work within Lincoln. So for me, it will be a 3. In our fourth category, urban landscape, superlatives abound in Lincoln. There are so many remarkable buildings. Let's start by orientating ourselves. Lincoln is split into a lower and upper town, and most of the famous buildings are at the top of the hill in the upper town, and you'll certainly need a cup of tea after climbing up there. So let's first of all talk about this hill and the resulting architectural influences.
As we said before, the geography of Lincoln really does hit you, probably as much as any other city or town you could go to in England. It really does characterise the town, just how this contrast between the top of the hill and the bottom of the hill. This is actually tremendously important for reasons you wouldn't expect to the archaeological preservation of so many of the old buildings in Lincoln we'll come on to talk about. Because the number one threat to archaeological preservation historically has always been farming, has always been agriculture. So many old buildings have been torn up, ploughed over. But of course, you can't really farm very easy on a steep hill. So of all we talked a lot about the major periods in its history when Lincoln was abandoned. Well, having the geography it does has meant that so much of the city has been preserved to this day. We should probably try and put a few numbers on the steepness of that hill, because it really is very, very steep. The incline is 16.12 degrees on average. And I think we can assure everyone it's a lot more than that in a lot of places. Daniel Defoe in the 1720s wrote about the trouble then that horse-drawn coaches had getting up to it. certainly I think a lot of people would struggle to get up it today. The Ordnance Survey says it's the fourth steepest street in England. But, and when you get up there, there are spectacular views from the bottom, from the top to the bottom, but also there are good views from the bottom of the hill up to the top to the Cathedral Tower, which can be seen right from the up the steep hill. But I think what's important to note here is the division is not just physical. The division is aesthetic in the different styles of architecture you see. And the division historically has been social as well. Daniel Defoe, again, when he was talking about the Uptown in the 1720s, said there are some very good buildings and a very good, great deal of very good company in the Upper City, clearly singling the Upper City out. And in Victorian Lincoln, the two areas, the Upper and the Lower City, really constituted two separate areas with minimal mixing and very different social structures. Living uphill was a sign of eliteness. And with industrial expansion, workers' houses weren't built into this area. They were built away from the hilltop, in contrast to the posh older Georgian townhouses built on the top before. There's a gazetteer description of the city from the 1870s, which tells us the lower or south section is locally designated below hill, presents an appearance much inferior to that of the upper section, and contains the principal shops and inns, the markets, the least prominent of the public buildings, and most of the abodes of the working population. So, as I said, the division isn't just physical and geographical. The division is aesthetic. The division is social and absolutely crucial to the urban development of Lincoln over the centuries.
That's right. And it's sort of still there today, isn't it? Sort of the chain stores and modern shops are at the bottom of the hill, and the sort of independents... But tea rooms and restaurants and independent shops are at the top. So let's talk about some of the buildings at the upper section, if you like. I think we have to start with Lincoln Cathedral, which is just this awesome cathedral building.
We will. Lincoln Cathedral, I think we have to get that there are some awesome facts about Lincoln Cathedral. It's believed, no one can be absolutely certain about this, but I think commonly acknowledged by most archaeologists and historians to have been formerly the tallest building in the world when its central spire was completed in 1311, which was 160 metres high. And what blows my mind about this, it was the first non-ancient building to have held this title. Until it was completed, the tallest building in the world was the Great Pyramid of Giza.
This is incredible, isn't it?
Completed, 4,500 years before. And
yeah.
The central spire collapsed in 1548, but had it not collapsed, it would have remained the tallest building in the world until the 1880s, when the Washington Monument and the Eiffel Tower were surpassed its height. So in that respect, there is an incredible link between the Great Pyramid of Giza and really the modern industrial world. Nothing else surpassed it for height in that time.
That is remarkable.
Absolutely.
And let's talk a bit about, should we talk a bit more about the cathedral itself, some of its architectural features?
Doesn't currently have any spires on any of its three towers, but it previously all three did have towers, but it's still an incredibly impressive building. It's built high up in a prominent location, which is very common for cathedrals, and as we said, explains why so many cathedrals survived the ravaging of farming at points when they're abandoned. It's built in the early Gothic style, but you can divide its structure really into three architectural periods. The west front is Norman, the towers are 14th and 15th century, and the library and cloister walks, as we mentioned, were added later in the 17th century. One interesting little thing we can see in Lincoln Cathedral is the Lincoln Imp. In one of the stone carvings. It's just a little carved devil. Local legend is that the devil sent it to the cathedral and it was turned to stone by an angel. But it's actually become an unofficial symbol of the city. Lincoln City Football Club has the nickname the Imps, and the Imp is the design on their badge after this.
And that's just one of many quite astounding architectural features of this cathedral. I mean, what springs to mind are the rose windows, the spectacular vaults across the top of the cathedral, and the detail of the Gothic style, as well as its sheer scale. So I think it's one of the largest cathedrals in the country, possibly the fourth largest by floor area. Episode one of the podcast, we talked about this.
We did. I think we did a short quiz on it. and another thing I'll mention briefly on the cathedral is famous people buried there. Eleanor of Castile She was wife of Edward I, who is probably most familiar as the baddie from Braveheart, the king in that. She died near Lincoln and was partially buried in the cathedral. Edward famously set up 12 Eleanor crosses on the route of her funeral procession from Lincoln to London, which ended at Charing Cross. There's a myth, which you might have heard, that the name of Charing Cross comes from the French chère reine, meaning dear queen cross. Which isn't true, but the name Charing is older, but the cross part of the name certainly does result from that. Her tomb does survive in Lincoln Cathedral, but the effigy on top is a 19th century replacement because the original was destroyed in the 1600s, but certainly probably the most famous figure that's buried in the cathedral there.
And I mean, the cathedral's a great place to visit, and for a long time it housed the Magna Carta, but that's now over at the castle, which I suppose brings us on to the other hugely prominent building at the top of the hill, a Norman castle built by, presumably initially by William the Conqueror. So William must have come over and said that's a good location for a castle on top of a hill. The crossroads of these Roman roads that you mentioned at the beginning, Fossway and Ermine Street. But what are the notable features of this castle? Because in some way, I mean, it's a very large castle, but it's got some really quite unique features.
Yeah, just give us a short history of it. You're right, the oldest parts were built by William the Conqueror in 1068, and he actually destroyed an awful lot of the houses in Lincoln in order to build it. Initially, he built it inside the enclosed Roman city, which still had defensible walls, which is quite an incredible link to the Roman past there. The present-day castle area was the inner bailey, whereas the rest of the city formed the outer bailey. You're talking about defensive walls here. So the castle complex was much bigger than you would imagine it by looking at it today. You had the inner defensive wall around where the current castle is, and a much bigger defensive wall going around kind of the city on top of the hill. It also has quite a lot of 19th century additions, an inner gateway, court buildings, and it still has an administrative function resulting from those additions today, with a court as well as a fantastic museum you can visit and see that original copy of the Magna Carta.
I mean, this is what I love about Lincoln Castle. I mean, the museum is great. You've got so many elements to it. You've got the medieval fortifications. You've got the ability of the Magna Carta, but also I like the fact that you can just wander in there. I mean, you have to pay to go into the main museum element, but you can just wander into the bailey of the castle and be within the walls. I mean, it's absolutely astounding.
Absolutely.
And the area around the castle and the cathedral, it's a lovely little area. It's a great area to hang out. There's a market. Lots of old buildings containing restaurants and shops. But we're going to go down the hill a bit towards the lower town. And I think the next building we absolutely have to mention for its fascinating history is the Jew's House.
It's notable as one of the oldest houses, domestic dwellings in England. It was owned by Jewish residents until Jews were expelled from Lincoln in 1290. And there was a medieval synagogue in the Jew's Court next door to the Jew's House. I think it's very important we put this all in some historical context. There were Jews living in England in the 13th century, but there was anti-Semitic hysteria whipped up in Lincoln by a blood libel claim that a child there had been ritually murdered by Jews. And then in 1290, all Jews were expelled from England under the Edict of Expulsion, which wasn't overturned until after the Civil War in 1657. And it's believed that it's at this point the Jew's house was stolen from its Jewish owner. The expulsion of the population, which was really the culmination of centuries of anti-Semitism, including blood libels, forced wearing of marking badges, and segregation. So there's not a particularly positive history to this. There are only about 2,000 Jews in England settled in about 15 urban communities across England, and they were all expelled from the country at that point. To talk about the building itself, it has been continuously occupied since it was built. It was turned into a restaurant in 1973 and I think is now a bookshop. What's really important architecturally about this is such a robust building. If you think about the kinds of medieval buildings that survive. It doesn't tend to be your run-of-the-mill domestic dwellings. It tends to be the grander buildings because they were built to such a higher architectural and building standard.
It tends to be religious buildings, doesn't it?
Exactly.
You don't normally get dwellings surviving.
Exactly. And we talked in the Bath episode, I think, about how Georgian architectural methods meant so many of the run-of-the-mill buildings survive today from that era. The Jews' house is kind of the exception that proves the rule for the Middle Ages. This was an ordinary town building, but made of stone to a high standard, not just wooden wattle, and has survived this day as a result. There are some similar buildings in Southampton, York, and Bury St Edmunds. But also there's another one in Lincoln. In Lincoln, the Norman house nearby was built in the late 12th century and is another incredibly rare surviving example of a Norman domestic building. So if you want to know more about domestic dwellings, about residential accommodation in the Middle Ages, you can't really do better than go to Lincoln.
And now, we said we would struggle in this section to cover everything, and the upper town is replete with fantastic buildings. So we're going to come down towards the lower town now and talk about the Lincoln Guildhall and the High Bridge, which are important buildings in the lower parts of the town.
The Lincoln Guildhall, built on the site of a Roman gateway, is the centre for local council meetings. It's been the centre for local council meetings since the 13th century in the chamber above the gateway, and is still used today for that purpose. Talk about the High Bridge. The High Bridge in Lincoln is the oldest building in Lincoln, which still has buildings, built in the mid-12th century, restored in 1902. It's one of the oldest masonry arch bridges in the country, and the only one which still has a secular medieval building on it. So we talked in the Wakefield episode about the bridge chapel that's in Wakefield and a few other places. Very rare here to have a secular medieval building built on top of a bridge.
And I mean, we are running out of time a bit, but I think we do have to mention it's got the odd Roman structure as well.
It has. I'll talk the Roman structures. We'll pick out the favourites there. You have the Mint Wall, which is a stone fragment of probably part of the Basilica, which was built in Lincoln. You have the Newport Arch, which is the only Roman gateway in Britain that's still used for traffic, that you can still drive through. There's another gateway incorporated into 27 Steep Hill. You can see other remnants of the Roman Wall which surrounded the city in Cecil Street, Northgate, and East Bight. East Bight is a particularly good place to see it because you can also see the ditch set up that surrounded the wall as a double defence mechanism. Also, several tiled Roman pavements have been found, which suggests that the town must have been a fairly wealthy settlement to be able to afford to tile its pavements. One last thing I'll talk about, moving on from the Roman period, if that's okay, is St Mary's Guildhall, because...
Oh, yes.
This is actually an interesting old building that's set away from the top of the hill. It's right down the bottom, getting past the station towards the football ground. St Mary's Guildhall was built of stone between 1160 and 1180, possibly as a royal palace for Henry II. And as we said before, he may have undergone a second crowning ceremony within that building. It was built over the Roman Fosse Way, which ran to Lincoln. And you can actually still see parts of the Fosse Way excavated from within that building.
So we've covered a huge amount there, but I think we're going to have to go on to the scoring. There's probably far more we could talk about it, but let's go on to the scoring. I just don't know where to start with Lincoln. It will get a very high score from me because it covers so many interesting architectural styles, but also some really important buildings, and we've waxed lyrical about the cathedral, the castle, but also the presentation of these buildings. And we talk about this a lot on the podcast. The setting of the buildings, the ability to walk between them, the quality of the architecture. And I think Lincoln's been very lucky in that it's been less affected by some of the major regenerations, which have caused destruction in cores of cities. There is a busy inner ring road, but it's sort of shoved out the way of view for most visitors. I particularly like the different styles in Lincoln, and also even coming away from the town centre. I mean, we walked to the football ground, as we mentioned. The architecture coming out of the town, but also the views looking into the city as you come out are fantastic. So I think this is a splendid urban environment. You need a few days in Lincoln. For me, it's going to be a very high score. It's going to be a 9.
Terrific score there. My feelings on Lincoln, there are so many superlatives here. The tallest building in the world for centuries some of the oldest houses in England, the steepest, I should say, significant street in England. It's really a reflection of what an important place Lincoln has been for centuries, that so many buildings could be built to such robust standards and be preserved, and also how the landscape of the city has helped with the preservation. As we said, you can't farm on a hill, and farming has historically been the number one cause of archaeological destruction in England. What we've been left with is a terrific city with a unique feel, which gives you maybe the best instinctive understanding through its geography of how the town has developed and existed throughout the centuries. So also a very good score for me. I'm only going to go slightly lower because I know there are other places which just have more to offer because of their size. There are other cities which have just a little bit more. So I need to leave some room to go up. So I'm going to give it, I'm going to give it a 9 as well. I think 9 gives me sufficient room to go up.
Oh, wow.
No, I think 9 is the right score there.
I suppose the one thing that Lincoln perhaps lacks is as much representation of 20th century architecture. So what you have got, it's done very well. We mentioned in Science and Industry the quality of the reuse of the industrial buildings towards Brayford Pool, and you've got the modern university buildings. But generally, there's a building called the Collect. There's the Modern Archaeology Museum, the collection. But generally, there's not many examples of 20th century architecture that's notable. It's less represented in the modern era, but I suppose that reflects the periods of growth.
I did quite like the Wetherspoons. Again, the one that might sound a very strange thing for a history podcast to say, but the one that goes down to the south of the station is an old converted theatre, and you can really get the layout of the theatre when you're in there. So yeah, I think it's not much to sound 20th century architecture, but I enjoyed it.
Okay, good. I don't think Wetherspoons needs any advertising. So we'll a good score all round there great scores in urban landscape. That's probably on par with Bath, so very strong. In our final category, reality versus expectation, we reflect briefly on how we felt Lincoln was compared to our perceptions of it or what we expected. What are your thoughts?
I'd be very careful on reality versus expectations because Lincoln is a major tourist destination.
It is. People, so expectations are high.
People know to go to Lincoln. If they're going to pick somewhere to go, it's going to be high up on the list. So we start at 5. We've said, I think, overwhelmingly positive things about Lincoln, particularly in politics and war, particularly in urban landscape. And I think where it exceeded my expectations, is, as I keep talking about, how you can really feel the impact of the geography, the impact of the physical heritage of the city, and how that invokes so many of the important events that have happened there. I think that is probably the one thing that really impacts you that you can't really prepare for before you go. I suppose the one thing that that rose me back a little bit is that there weren't, in researching this, many surprises. There wasn't much that I found that really blew me away, with perhaps the exception of the fact about the cathedral being the tallest building in the world for thousands of years, that one link between the Great Pyramid of Giza and the Washington Memorial and the Eiffel Tower. Broader topics, there wasn't a huge amount that I didn't know about. So I think that balances out. So I'm going to give it a middle of the road score. I think I'm going to give it 5.
You're right. Expectations have to be high with Lincoln because these buildings are so famous. I'm going to give it a slightly positive score, though, because I feel in Lincoln, I can get a bit closer to the history than I do in other cities I visit with, which often have well-promoted buildings, cathedrals, castles, and so on. I love the fact you can just wander inside the castle. I like the way the centre's presented. And maybe I'm biased here, but I like good urban planning. I like coming out of a station, walking calmly through a city. It feels walkable, despite the steep hill. And it feels kind of relaxing, even though it's busy. So it just edges slightly above what I'd expect. So for me, it's going to be a 6.
So that's 11 out of 20 on reality versus expectations. That's given what we've said, given the way our expectations were about Lincoln, given how famous it is, I think it has to count that as a pretty decent score, 11 out of 20. So overall, Lincoln scored 17.5 out of 20 on politics and war, 5.5 out of 20 on science and industry, 3.5 out of 20 on art and culture, 18 out of 20 on architectural and urban heritage, 11 out of 20 on reality versus expectations. So that's 55.5 out of 100 overall. So despite slightly disappointing showings in science and industry and in art and culture, it's got really terrific scores in politics and war and urban landscape, which have really lifted its score up into the realms of positivity.
It has a very similar scoring profile to Bath. Perhaps that shouldn't surprise us. Well, that was an absolutely fascinating episode. Thank you so much, Daniel, for so much insight there. And for me in particular, all the information about the anarchy, the First Baron's War, absolutely fascinating. Where are we off to next?
We are off to another famous city towards the north of England. We're going to Lancaster.
Lancaster! Oh, can't wait. And I, do you know what? I know very little about Lancaster, so this one should be a lot of fun.
Excellent. Yeah, I've started the research. I'm already massively enjoying it. There's going to be a lot to say, I think.
So thank you, everyone, for listening. Please leave us comments and feedback on the website, theoldieguide.com. You can also leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, leave a score on Apple or Spotify. We'd really appreciate that feedback if you've got time. But for now, that's bye from me.
And bye from me.